feel right at home. Sounds like gunshots.
And you didn't duck.
I'm used to it. My name is Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, thank James and Rachel for having me here. About another 7 or 8 weeks of doing this or so. And get to share what it was like, what happened, what it's like now as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, my big book, my sponsor, and a loving God. God separated me from alcohol on June 23rd, 1988. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I say that because I am, and anything less than that would be falsely humble. So I'm grateful to be here as a recovered member, an upstanding member of a sacred fellowship. And before we get going, I just want to share something really neat happened. I was talking to Art and some of the guys about this earlier today. In fact, I even sent a picture to Art over the weekend about this. I was in between Cincinnati and Kentucky over the weekend to do one of these deals. And they took me to the oldest clubhouse in the country. Not the oldest meaning, but the oldest clubhouse. It started in 1945. And they had a cigarette machine, the old cigarette machines, actually a telephone booth with the swinging door, and that they get 12-step calls on, which is still active. And they had all these group rooms, and I sat in on a meeting Saturday morning. And the only thing that contradicted old AA is when they closed with the Serenity Prayer instead of the Lord's Prayer, they did, it works if you work, it's a work at your work, and I can picture Bill and Bob doing that, but that's what they did. But I met some of the old-timers there, and met a whole bunch of them at the meeting that night at the little conference thing they had. And I just kind of walked around. And they were telling me some of the stories of the drunks who have come through, but not enough because a lot of them weren't around in 1945 when they put the key in the door for a clubhouse that has saved many lives. And for me, the way I've been brought up in this, I get to touch our history. I obviously wasn't even born in 1945, but just to sit back and think of the drunks walking through with no treatment center, with no detox other than an AA chair, and how we would nurse each other through the night and drive them immediately to God. And there was no such thing as 90 meetings in 90 days, and no one was interested in your feeling or processing your feelings. They were interested in getting you sober. And, you know, bringing a brown bag in and having a guy take a couple of pops during a coffee break so he didn't go down off the chair. And the things like that. And I've heard these stories over the years. My lineage goes back to Dr. Bob, and I've heard those stories firsthand of what they did, and I was able to do that. And what I wish, what my hope would be, not only the obvious getting recovered through the 12 steps and passing it on and being part of the sacred fellowship, that every new person, every person really can touch history. And we can study comes of age a whole lot, and we get to touch the history and see what the members went through and how blessed we are that we have a meeting book. And we can select what meeting we want to go to. There was nothing like that going on. There was a meeting and you went at the beginning of 1 week. We need to touch the history to know where we come from. Because when we forget where we come from, AA looks nothing like what it started out to be. And a lot, get on a soapbox, a lot of our meetings are so politically correct and touchy-feely, we forgot what we're here for. And so I got to touch some of that. And the trip I'm going to make, and I promise myself I'm going to do this, is to Akron and go to Founders Day and to see the Mayflower Hotel. And one of my teachers has been there a few times because he lives out there. And it's up on the second floor and it's roped off and it's a tour. They haven't touched it. And it's one of those things where you can't touch anymore. Like they can't come in and rebuild around it. It's there. It's like a monument. And right. And so they still have the phone booth and where Bob walked before he, where Bill walked before he met Bob. And I thought that was pretty cool. And so if anyone's new, AA didn't start in 2013 at a treatment center. AA started with one drunk helping another, and there were no treatment centers other than a hospital, what we would call now a detox, and you got through it and you went to an AA meeting and turned your own life over to God. On your knees in front of a bunch of other drunks. And quite frankly, you didn't care what religion you came from. You get on your knees and this is how we do it because what you're doing doesn't work. And they were desperate enough to say, I'm putting everything aside because this is it. This is the last knot in the rope. And if I decide how this is going to look, I'm going to drink and die. And they approached this with a great sense of urgency. I remember being at a workshop one time in Long Island, New York, and there was a bunch of us there, my grand sponsor was doing it with another guy, Gary B. from Indiana, and he says, we'd like to do the third step together. If everyone would like to get on their knees, we do the third step. One woman says, I don't get on my knees. And someone straightened her right up. And she got on her knees, and we all held hands and prayed, because that's what they did. And they were trying to duplicate what we did at the beginning. And it really kind of swings into where I'm getting moved to start tonight, which is with step one and just a review of how we got to step five, which I hope to cover a little bit more of tonight. And if there's a reservation to my, can I drink again or not safely? If there's a lurking notion that somehow, some way I can control it, then those reservations and lurking notions are going to show up when I hit step one, when I hit step three, when I hit step five and have to turn it over, when I get to amends, when I'm asked to follow strict spiritual disciplines in 10 or 11 because there's a reservation, there's a lurking notion that somehow, some way I can run the show. And when I was brought to a place of utter defeat, complete desperation, on my way into Alcoholics Anonymous, what one of my sponsors would call step zero, that when I showed up here and they gave me suggestions or directions, I wasn't about debating, even though I didn't like it. There were many things I was asked to do that I didn't like, and every fiber in my being said, do not do this. And it was all coming from the mind, because that's the great resistor. But in my heart of hearts, I knew these people are sober a lot longer. They seem to have an semblance about their life. They seem to be right. So I had to follow. And ultimately, when I would follow, I would cross from one side to the other. And then, like a good alcoholic, take credit for making a good decision. Because the ego is going to always reconstruct it. Ego is always going to rebuild itself. And when we show up here, no matter how willing we are to do anything, there's still the ego in place. Except the ego never tells us, I'm in place, I'm still driving your life away from God, away from the solution, and it'll pretty up the junkyard. So when a drunk tells me I know what I need to do, I know they're in serious trouble. When a drunk tells me I don't know what to do anymore, I know they're in a great place. Now when you say I know what to do, that usually feels good. When you say I don't know what to do, that doesn't feel good. But if it feels good, doesn't mean it's good. And if it feels bad, it doesn't mean it's bad. And the best thing I could have done is surrender and say, I don't know what to do anymore. I'm out of solutions. I'm going to die. That day did not feel good. And I was brought to treatment number 7. Interesting thing happened to me. I was brought to Newark Airport from Staten Island, New York. And before I got to the airport, I was discharged after about 10 days or so from the 7 treatment center. And I was still getting the post-acute withdrawal. I was shaking, I was vibrating, I was sweating, I couldn't hold food. And that afternoon at the house, we were driving up from my house, about a 2-hour drive from Amityville, Long Island to Staten Island, New York. And on the way there, I'm thinking, I'm jumping out of the car. Now, my dad was driving me. I should have had a pit bull next to me with a nicer ride, right? And I'm thinking, the first red light, I'm bailing. I've got to get a drink in me. As soon as he's not paying attention, I'll turn up the radio, listen to the music. I've got to get out of here. And we drove up to the house, and I said, this is the last chance I got to go. He's going to get out of the car, walk in the house. I'm on the passenger side. I can just run. And I followed him in the house. And he was in the house, and I'm walking around, and I'm vibrating, and my mind is at me. Got to get out of here. Get a Mr. Boston in you. And that afternoon, my dad said to me, how you doing? And normally I would have said, great, but I said, I'm not doing good. I don't feel good. And he knew what I meant. Now, my dad knows nothing about this God, nothing about recovery, but God works through people. And when we are open, suddenly messengers appear all over. In the thousands. So my dad made a big pot of pasta, and which I couldn't even look at. I couldn't eat. My dad's remedy for everything is pasta. It'll fix everything. And we went out on the back porch. And my dad, we had for the first time a father and son talk. Now, he didn't know really what I was going through. He just knew I was in rough shape. And we talked. And I remember getting the impulse to call the treatment center, which I would never do. This was all God connecting dots, like God connects dots for you when we don't know what to do. And I called the treatment center, and I talked to this counselor, and I didn't forget her because I had a crush on her. She looked like Mary Tyler Moore. I never forget it. And she answered the phone, and she said, how are you doing? I said, I'm terrible. I'm dying. I'm not going to make it. I had one day to get to the airport. to go out to Minnesota. And she talked me down off the ledge, and she shared with me how she felt the same way when she was going through what I've been going through. And I talked to my dad, and I went to bed that night. It was not a good night. I tossed and turned all night. My mind was driving, get out, go get a drink, get out, go get a drink, and God kept me put. We got to the airport the next day, and my kid brother and my dad took me to the airport. And it was pre-9/11, so you can go pretty far. You can walk right up to that little gateway where you get on the plane. And they walked me up there, make sure I didn't escape. And as I'm walking on the plane, I'm loaded with hate, fear, remorse, guilt. I got all of it. And I felt like I was the only person walking around the entire Newark airport. And I can feel the pressure on my shoulders. And as I'm walking on, I remember I got this thing in me, this movement to turn and look back at them to say goodbye or something. And I remember my kid brother crying, he had tears rolling down his eyes. And he said something like, please get better. And my dad, I know my dad, and he was trying to fight him back. He would not cry. He was just trying to fight back. But his eyes were all glassy. And when I got to my seat, I remember making a sincere prayer. Father, whatever I got to do to help them, I'll do. I wasn't saying any lengths. I want to go to the big book and speak. It was just whatever it takes to help them, I'll do. And I crossed from point A to point B. I crossed that bridge from wanting to want to stop to I'll do anything to stay stopped. And I didn't care what you threw at me, but I was going to follow directions, even when I would back up a little bit on some of the directions. And I had to get read the Riot Act a few times in my first 6 months. There was a gentleman in Minnesota who called me into his office, and he used every four-letter word on me that he can think of. I think he invented a few that day because he saw me going sideways, and I can't see myself going sideways. By the time I was discharged from this sober house, I was going to some really rock-solid Mad Dog Big Book meetings. And they showed me how to live sober. When they took me into their homes, they took me to the diner. And these folks knew I had no money and was living in a halfway house. And there were no distractions like chasing skirts. I had nothing. I knew one thing. If I drink, I'm going to die. And everything they're telling me to do, if I don't do, I'm going to drink and I know I'm going to die. That was made abundantly clear to me. And even with that, I went sideways. But they would take me to the diner and they would order for me. And when the check came, they didn't even look at me for money because they knew I was pretty embarrassed about it. And AAs took care of me. And they would pick me up and take me to a meeting. And they knew it wasn't a waste of time because I was asking questions. How did you get this job? How do you do this? How do you do a fourth step? How do you do this? And they would keep talking to me and answering my questions. They sensed sincerity within me, even though I couldn't see it, because they kept spending time with me. By the time I got my first sponsor, I knew what I suffered from. And I say this because there are so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's so many people in treatment, there's so many people who get out of treatment, come into AA, and you sit down and talk to them, they'll tell you every psych issue that they have on the planet, but they don't know what they suffer from. They don't have a clue what a real alcoholic is. They don't have a clue what the solution is. And when they hear God, they think of religion, and they back up like most of us, they're agnostic. They have skepticism and doubt when it comes to this word called God. In fact, they always tell you, don't talk about politics or God in strange company. We're no different. Even talk to some AAs about God, and we get into religion and we become warring theologians. When we get to the top of the hill, it's the same God. We're going to take different routes up there, and I'll argue with anyone about this. No loving God is going to split us. Man will. And self-imposed crisis on people. That's why AA stood out of religion. We have a 10th tradition. Leave it out there. Go worship on your own. Take it to the max. But in here, we need to get along. They knew that. That's all God inspired. God says, don't need to drop my name in here. Just call me high power, call me God. You don't need to call me some specific deity. Don't worry about it. I'm sure he said a lot nicer than that. I'm sure God never said, don't worry about it. God has a pinky ring, sunglasses, and gold jewelry. How you doing? And my conception of my higher power was a GOD, group of junks with your only direction. Because the old timers, I would sit near them. Or if they remembered your name, it was a great thing. They went from kid to hate Pete. Sit with us. And they would give me coffee. And they'd say, you're going to be all right. And I used a group of drunks for good orderly direction as my higher power, because there was power in the numbers. There was safety in the numbers. And I'd walk into meeting, okay, I'm nervous, I'm scared, but I'm going to be okay for an hour. But they explained to me in Minnesota what the problem was. And they told me I was doomed to drink. There was no way out of not drinking as a real alcoholic. I can't think the drink through. I can't play the tape to the end. I can't remember where I come from. I can process my feelings all I want. And if I can't get in touch with my feelings, they told me, don't worry, the feelings will get in touch with you. They says, you're more serious than you think you are, and you know your condition is critical. And they quoted an old-timer called Chuck Chamberlain, which I adore the guy. Terminal illness is what I suffer from as a real alcoholic. I'm going to die from this. The difference between this and another terminal illness is I can get recovered, not cured from it. And the solution is so simple. It's G-O-D. Nothing less than that great fact. We read it on page 25, that I'm going to get rocketed into a fourth dimension. And we read that all the time. How many folks know what the fourth dimension means? We hear it, we read it, we don't know what it means. It's a God existence. It's beyond the three dimensions to which we've been living forever, driven by emotions, obsessions, and compulsions. That's an alky. My emotions got to feel good, and it's self-serving. Totally about me. Obsessions and compulsions, we know what that's like, because if we're not drinking, we're obsessing and acting out on other areas, and we run to the ground with it. We run it into the ground. We get rocketed past that. Past worldly clamors, past the world as we know it, because let's face it, it's romper room out there. It's make-believe world out there. People think we meditate to escape reality. I meditate to experience the only reality that is, and that's God. Who tells me how to go through life, how to navigate through life? But if I'm not clear on step one and my desperation to seek God, it's all just words on a page. How many folks have I run into that I've read the big book, I can't get sober? That's what the problem is, you're reading it. It's not the daily news or a novel. It's a textbook to which we study and get internalized to have an experience with, to go from bondage to freedom. Go from bondage to spiritual wings. We get free. We don't need a thinking mind anymore. God is God. You believe in this God. I believe in this God. So what? We believe in God, which means all love, no opposite. We get along fine now. But as soon as we start eking our opinions into it, we're going to go to war. Unless we're so evolved and so enlightened that I don't even care, as long as I bring love to you and I'll build a bridge even if you hate me. That's why AA is so sacred. That's why AA is so unique. That's why it's around so long. It's my job to carry the torch. Huh? It's our job to carry the torch. So I have a terminal illness called alcoholism. I'm going to drink regardless of what you put in front of me. And I'm powerless over the drink. I'm powerless over dry goods. I'm powerless over sex. I'm powerless over food. I'm powerless over money. I'm powerless over any kind of addiction before I even act out. Because it all comes from the troublemaker, the mind. Which is dying to kill me, will settle for me drunk. And it will pretty up a junkyard. And who lives in the mind with free room and board is this thing called the ego. That we run that into the ground. And all it does is ease God out. Wants no part of God. Wants you not sitting in a workshop like this. Don't even want to hear the word God or 12 steps or recovery. It likes drama. It gives it something to do. The ego is insecure and fear. So it needs stuff. But it's like the scared little child turning the corner, waiting to see who's there, and then shows up with bravado, shows up by isolating, just shows up, but to get me away from you. And we have it. Ego's got a free board and free room and board and a martini. Lounge chair, it's not going anywhere. And we'll find fault. You know what a fault finder is when you sponsor them? They're looking to challenge you and find fault. And I say, well, based on what you've been doing, how's that working for you? Right? I mean, I'm in a treatment center business. The complaints I hear. I know what I need to do. How's that working? How many treatments have you got? 35? Good job. You know? I'm only sober 25 years. I think I know what I'm doing. Right? And we come into AA and we try to tell our sponsor how they should sponsor us. You know what that tells me? We've got a first step problem. That's all that is. It's a first step. Everything takes us back to step one. Which starts in this wonderful instrument, this predator called the thinking mind. It drives me back to a drink, and I pick up a drink. We have this thing called a craving, phenomenon of craving, that I crave more alcohol when I drink. Never satisfied. Never. Give me five, I need 10. Give me 10, I'm on a drunk. I disappear for 4 or 5 days. And I come back and say, what's the problem? Or I use excuses. And regardless, I remember the first time I got arrested. Because I had a really good connection with the judge through this young lady that I was arrested with, I got a slap on the wrist. I got released on my own ROR, and I had to pay a little fine, and they cut me loose. Now, when I came out of the Tombs in New York, who was in the front row was my dad and his uncles, and all I can think of is I'm better off doing 10 years than facing them. And I'm standing before the judge, and I'm scared to death because I'm hoping this connection pulled off what they said they were going to do, but I didn't know. And I'm standing in front of the judge, and I'm the same clothes for about 3 days, so I'm laying up in the Tombs, and all I can think of is how am I going to get out of their grips, meaning my dad and my uncles, to go get loaded up again. I got to figure out, this is while the judge is reading all this stuff and about to release me. I'm thinking, they're going to pick me up, they're going to get in the car, I'm going home, how do I get around this, because I need to get loaded up. One more time. That's how we operate. Nowadays, if God forbid I got a speeding ticket, I'm never speeding again. I don't want to break the law. Back then it was different. So I pick up a drink and the body craves more alcohol, and it's all because I'm not right with God. I can believe in God all I want. I've sponsored priests, can't get sober. I've sponsored people who do this, who work in the treatments, therapists, clinicians, can't get sober. They know everything with the mind. This guy knows everything about Scripture. Can't stop drinking. There's a problem. There's a God problem. It's not about knowledge of God. It's about what's my experience and relationship with God, which brings us into step two, when I'm convinced that I'm done in step one. And I have to go beyond wanting to want to stop. A lot of us get stuck on that. It's like being stuck in neutral, wanting to want to stop. I wish I can want to be like he does, but I still got a reservation, a lurking notion. 1988, it was gone. I didn't know if I was going to even be in AA. I didn't know what was going to happen to me, where I was going to live. I just knew I can't do this anymore. And that was a great thing. And when they offered me halfway house and sober living, and I was out in Minnesota for almost 11 months, I balked a few times. But I thought, where else am I going to go? I have no home, no money, no job. And God, what God did for me was remove everything so I couldn't hang on something. Well, I got this girl back there, I got a wife back there, I got a job back, I got to go make money, all removed. The other thing is, even if I had money, even if I had a relationship, even if I had a job, if I was going to lock into that before my recovery, I'd be dead or drunk right now. Anything I put before God or recovery, I'm going to lose. I'm going to wind up sucking on a pint of something. And when I hear people throw that up, I know they're not ready yet. They're just not ready. That's just the nature of the beast. A lot of folks come in here, the minority stay. And in that minority is even a small minority who get into this book. And those are the folks that we look to for guidance. Right? Step two talked about this power greater than myself is going to restore me to sanity, wholeness of mind. And like I said, I used a group of drunks for good old direction. And I love being around the old timers. They had one-liners for everything. And a lot of the old timers, God put my path. Not all, but a lot of them were in this book. My first hero, Vince Dowling, who's passed on. I met him counting days. He had 30 years sober. He looked just like Dr. Bob. And he told me his story one day. And he told me the solution was in a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And over a 15-minute meeting, he told me what I suffered from and how I was going to get well. And nothing in between. He was grateful I had no job and no relationship and no money and I was in the street. Because that's where he came from. He's got nothing in the way. Except one thing. The alcoholic mind. And on his word, I went from New York to Minnesota. Because he was a drunk that understood me. He was the first drunk. When he told me a little bit of his story, he anted up. I says, finally, thank you. Someone knows me. They walk in my skin. They know me. I went to Minnesota. The only skepticism and doubt I had about God came not from God, but from a thinking mind. There's no problem with God towards us. There never is, never will be. It's us towards God. And I associated God with my religion. I had lots of problems with my religion. I had a lot of problems with my church and the clergy there. So I put a broad stroke across God. Because if the players were sick, the players didn't do what I want, the whole Catholic religion was wrong. How dare I? I was finding the speck in your eye and had a 2x4 in mine. which is typical of what we do. I start going to the work with the sponsor, and they brought me through one again. And I wrote out a history of my alcoholism and the consequences, the unmanageability, how I was living life on self-will. And I saw in black and white, like Bill writes his story in the first 9 pages of what I was. And I immediately could identify with Bill Wilson. There was identification. I saw the solution in two, the pointer to it, and I was willing to go in step three. And we have this beautiful third step prayer. And here's what I offer you. If we don't continue to turn our life over to God, the illness will take it right back and do anything it wants with us. And if we think it was bad in the past, we've only just begun. Because there's something called progression. If I'm sober 10, 15, 20 years and I go drink, God forbid, it's as if I've been drinking 10, 15, 20 years. It's ruthless. We know that. So I got to continue to surrender to this God because I am broken. I surrender to this power called God and turn everything over to God, because if I don't, my illness will take it right back. It's dying to have my life back. It doesn't care I'm sober 24, going on 25 years. It couldn't care. It says, we've waited. We'll wait a little bit longer. We'll get them. I was talking to some guys at work. I said, it's kind of like running down a dark alleyway and you got God's hands, God saying, hold on, I'm going to pull you through. And if I sit back and say, well, let me think about this, here comes the illness. And it's going to pull me right back again. And in desperation that we experience in step one, well, I turn everything over, not know where I'm going. This God is vague, it's out there somewhere, but I'm going anyway. It's better than what I was doing. And my life is no longer any of my business. Which brings me back to step one. When I start to balk and I experience resistance, or I'm sponsoring someone, or I hear men and women saying there are conditions on what the recovery journey is supposed to look like, there are conditions on what I'm supposed to have as I get sober, we have a step one problem, because my life is none of my business. And we turn everything that we think is joyful and everything that is sorrowful over to God. All goes to God. Not for me to select, unless I have a first step problem. Then I'm in the business of being selective. Well, I need a cell phone to recover. I need my car. I need her or him. I need to make some money and then I can pay attention to God. Really? How's that been working? Right? For me, there was nothing. And I'll tell you, at the time, it didn't feel good, because there were plenty of times I saw guys working and making money. Some guys make money quick. We all know those guys, no matter what they touch, turns into gold. And, you know, they're like 4, 5, 6 months and they lock into jobs, or they're going to the gym and they're looking great. They got the girl and everything's clicking. And I got nothing. And I'm starting to feel like, what am I doing wrong? Something's wrong with my recovery. All I was doing was chopping wood, carrying wood, and getting the ground fertile. And my life was about God, steps, AA, whatever I can do. I lived in AA. Those guys, I don't know where they are anymore. I don't know. The flesh is weak. And not only just flesh, but flesh meaning external conditions. It's seductive. It'll suck us right. It'll take us there. And we fall. I'm either with God or I'm not. I'm either all in or I'm not. Can't be a little bit in. Got to be all in. Even if I don't know what I'm doing, I'm committed to this power called God. I don't know how to do that. Let's do the 12 steps. It'll take us right there. It says in chapter 4 that this book will enable me to find the power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. This book is going to do it for me. And at some point, we can go back to our religious communities and be great members of our religious community. Just remember where our home is. We do those things along with, not instead of, because we're alcoholics. And we need to nurture the spirit, and we get it here. We need to speak to each other. I can talk to a clergy. I can talk to a shrink. I can talk to a civilian about what I'm going through. And they'll get, you know, they'll go along with me and give me some encouragement. Beautiful thing. But when I speak to you about being an alcoholic, you know what I'm talking about. We speak each other's language. We come to get, we stay to give. I did inventory and cleared away everything that was in my life that was blocking me from God. I had to get rid of the obstacles that were blocking me from God. Based on my life, run on self-will, and my desire to play God in every single area of my life, including signing you a role, God a role, me a role, and everything else a role. I saw how fear was the evil and corroding thread, fear-based and insecure. Everything I said, thought, and behaved was all coming from fear. Currently, do I get dressed because I got to impress? Do I get dressed because I get dressed for AA? or because I'm going to an affair because I want to, or do I get dressed because if I don't, people will think something wrong with me? Two different worlds. Pull up to a red light in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, rainy night. Pull up to a red light, no one's around, I'm tired. Okay? Look at the red light, it's a long light, I live across the street. I look left, I look right, no cops. I could run this light. No one's around, it's raining, it's a windy night, cold New York night, I'm at the light, it's a 5 minute light, oh my God, I gotta get home, I'm so tired. I could run the light, who's gonna know there's no cop? And I say, I know the cops, they're probably hiding, I won't run the red light. And I wait, and I go through when it's a green light. Same situation, 2 o'clock in the morning, cold, winter, rainy New York night, I come to a red light. Okay, red light. Wait, green light, and go through. What's the difference between the two? One is compliance, and one have I changed. I don't break the law. It doesn't even enter my mind. It's a red light, I wait. The other guy is trying to figure an angle and is not doing it because fear of the consequences. That's compliance. And if I'm in a place of compliance, I'm going to have conditions. Eventually, I'm going to hit that red light. I'm going to go through. Because if I catch it tomorrow night, I say, you know, I didn't get, there was no one around last night, I'm going through. The person who's been evolved, who's changed, who's been enlightened, says, red light, I don't break the laws. I wait. Maybe God has a, you know, we are, God has a reason for me catching this red light. And so I wait. Two different sets, two different way to operate in this life. Compliance and surrender. And if I'm in a place of compliance, that fourth step will go on forever. I will look to pay someone to write my fourth step. It's never going to get done. But when I know the illness is breathing down my back and I got to get it done, I better get it done, I got to get it done, I better get it done, because if not, I'm going to drink and die. I'm writing. I'm not watching TV. I'm not going out on a date. I'm not going shopping. I'm going to skip a meal. I got to get it done. And for me, I kind of burned the candle living in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. I had nothing. I would sit at this bookshelf that I made into a desk and would write until I got tired and God said, okay, put the book away. And the next night I come home from a meeting and write and write and write, and it got done, and stuff would pop off the pen. And God was doing for me what I can never do for myself, putting my deepest, darkest stuff on paper. And people in AOA were encouraging me to do that. It's a good thing to do. So sometimes we feel like God's not working, and sometimes what we need to do, and where's God in all this? I just need to look back at where I've been and where I am right now. Oh my Lord, I was living in a busted up, abandoned building hallway, hadn't bathed for I don't know how long. I don't know, last thing I ate, Twinkies and a beer was my meal. You know what I used to eat? You're going to think I'm lying. Before I got thrown out of this apartment, there was a box of spaghetti. I used to take a chunk of spaghetti, this is about 3-4 times, break them in half, put them in my pocket. And there was a box of Domino's sugar cubes, put them in the other pocket. My hand to God, that's what I ate. Hard spaghetti and sugar cubes. Because if I hustled up 30, 40 bucks on the street, that wasn't going for food in my belly. It's not happening. I'll go hungry. And once I'm drunk, I don't want to eat anyway. I'm only going to pass out. And then when I was homeless, I'd boost a bag of Twinkies from the store and buy a beer, and that would be good. That's okay. I'm good. This is the existence to which I was living. So here I am in this little apartment, little studio. There's nothing in there. I'm paying the rent for it. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. And a few times he says, where's God? And I said, oh yeah, God's doing great here. I work every day, self-supporting through my own contributions. I don't have a lot. I'm above ground, sober, and sucking air. Got a sponsor. I'm a member of a sacred fellowship. Life is pretty cool. Like the first night I slept in this apartment, I slept in a sleeping bag. Someone gave me a sleeping bag. I had AA bumper stickers all over the door, something that represents my higher power above the door. I had my big book, I had scripture. And I slept in a sleeping bag, and I was in paradise. It beat the streets. I didn't need a cell phone. I didn't get my first car till I was married. Nothing was in the way. I was in paradise, sleeping on a hard floor, with no curtains, no phone. There was nothing. And I just moved in a sleeping bag at someone in AA said, maybe you can use this. I know you don't have a bed. And I crawled, and I even had to do this, because what do I know from a sleeping bag? I get in this thing. But I got my Bible, I got my big book, and I got my AA bumper stickers, and my God up above the door. I made my prayer and slept. I was in paradise that night. I woke up in paradise. I've been in paradise since. And sometimes life stuff gets in the way. I need stuff. I got to get stuff. Because I'm not complete if I don't have my stuff. My higher power wore a robe and sandals, and they weren't Gucci, and changed the planet. Spirit is spirit. Spirit doesn't need a Mercedes Benz. Spirit is spirit. God will give me exactly what I need to walk the journey he has set out for me. And if I'm going to be rich, there's a reason why. If I'm going to be poor, there's a reason why. It's all glorious. It's all paradise when I understand God's will for me, not my will for me. My will for me is my problem. My will for me is when I experience fear, skepticism, doubt, frustration, anger, and then I need a drink. When I'm living according to God's will for me, everything's great. Whether I'm driving a Volkswagen or Ferrari, I'm here for God, man. That's the path I'm going. It's about giving it all back anyway. And I sat with this fifth step. This came, rubber hit the road, because I had to discuss my resentment inventory, my fear inventory, and my sex inventory to another man. And my sponsor walked on water up until that day when I had to go to his house for the appointment. And suddenly I'm thinking, who is this man, and why am I doing this for? Right? And the mind is kicking right back in, because this fifth step is a big deal. It says if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. So either do a fifth or drink one. What was I going to do? And I hit my knees, and this was God working for me. I just hit my knees. Father, get me to Tony's house. I don't want to drink and die. Knock at the door. He said, come on in. And we sat, and we prayed, and we meditated. He asked me some questions, and off we went. There's some neat things in step five, which we really should talk about. It says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude. What's my attitude towards God going into step five? What's my attitude about God in step 9, 10, and 11? A new attitude, one that's open, one that's even enlightened, one that's willing to grow towards it, one perhaps without skepticism and doubt, but a new attitude that God, I'm here to serve God. And what I find out on the other side of the archway, God's pursuing me and looking to serve me. Think about this. In serving God, I find out how God's giving me, God's serving me. But I need to serve. I got clothes on my back. I got a roof over my head. I have a job that I get paid for. I eat. I have wonderful people in my life. It's all God saying here. To walk this journey here. And if any of those things are going to hurt you, I will remove them. And all I do is, God, how do I serve you? I've said this a million times. The man or woman who walks with greed in their heart wants everything and achieves nothing. And the man or woman who walks with humility, which we get from God, it's a byproduct, wants nothing and achieves everything. Gets it all in here. And at the end of the day, when we're right in here, everything's right. We wear the world like a loose garment. It says a new relationship with our Creator. I need a new relationship with God. My book just tell me that. Because obviously the one I've had in the past doesn't work. My God was Jack Daniels, Mr. Boston, Blackberry Brandy, or her, or money, or prestige, or property, external conditions. That was my God. Look at me, how great I am. But I was dying on the inside. The reason why I was an overachiever in school, I was a bright kid in school, but I had to overachieve. I was a gifted musician. I had to overachieve. I had to be the smartest kid and the greatest musician ever to hit the planet for one reason. If I wasn't, you'd think less of me. That's bondage. That's not freedom. I told a guy today, just be the spoke in the wheel. Don't be the wheel. Just be a spoke in the wheel. Be a player. We have admitted certain defects, ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is, and put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. These are about to be cast out, not worked on, not dealt with. I can't deal with my defects. I can't deal with them in 6 and 7. I'm not going to work on my defects. I don't know how to do that. I will pump energy into them. They need to be cast out like bad garbage. And God's going to do that for me because he needs every one of us to do work for him. can't be walking around with bondage. And the things that he allows us to keep, like our past experiences, it's to help someone else. I went through a divorce. How do you go through a divorce? I got married for good. You don't go through a divorce. When I came on the other side of the divorce, you know how many men came to me and says, I'm going through a divorce. How'd you do it? So my past becomes a great asset. And there was nothing shameful, embarrassing about it because I went through it like a gentleman, which was all God. It says, this requires action on my part, which when completed will mean I've admitted to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my defects. When we skip down, it says, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. It says, when we decide who's to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, step four, and prepare for a long talk. Now, when I do these 5 steps, my attention spans about 2 hours. Then I get like ADD. I can't, you know. And I know that. I don't do marathon 5 steps. 2 hours, and I need to be of maximum service to the drunk sitting in front of me. So I know 2 hours is usually my cutoff point, and I shut it down. And we'll continue the next day or whenever we can get together again. But I pray. I have a religious thing that always carries me. I ask them if it's okay to put it on their table so they don't object. We read a little out of here and off we go. And I take notes as they're reading. I'll stop them once in a while. I'll ask them to read only what's on paper unless I need to ask you a question because I want to hear what God gave you, not what you're giving me. It says we explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. Most sponsors know this, right? They should realize we're engaged upon a life and death errand. I love this. Our book says a 5th step is a life and death errand. And you worried about a cell phone or your car or how much money you have in your pocket? That's not going to kill you. Not doing this will. This is a life and death errand. And as a sponsor, do you see the responsibility God has given us who've been around? He's entrusting us, drunks, with another human being, another one of his children's lives. What a huge responsibility. This is why I go pray, meditate before they show up or I go to the house. Because I know I'm doing God's work. I better be right. I better be clear, empty, and open because I got to hear what they're not telling me. I got to see when their body starts to shift. I got to see when their eyes roll or they're looking at their shoes. There's something going on and I need to get in and rip out. Because their life's in my hands. My father said, trust this person with you. I don't just listen and say, okay, what time's the game on? Just keep moving. I'm there. And also respect the drunk enough to say, I can't go any further. I need to stop now. I'm burnt. It says we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And I put a bracket around the word past because we're done for the first half of the 5th step. Now we go in. This is all the preparation work. Now we go in and we sit and we talk and we actually do the 5th step. And then when we're done, we pick it up. Because 5th step, by the way, is part of the house cleaning process. When we come out of the 5th step, it says, once having taken the step, it's done. We're holding nothing. We're delighted. Promise. 5th step promise is coming up. We can look the world in the eye. Remember how we used to look at our shoes all the time? Couldn't have a conversation to look at you in the eye. I'd be looking all over because I'm shame-based. I have remorse. I have guilt. I have self-loathing. Now I'm able, little by slowly, to start make eye contact. I tell you something. One of the things my dad first noticed to me, my dad's the type of guy, when you speak to him about the weather or whatever, he's looking you right in the eyes. He doesn't move. And if you don't look at him in the eyes, you're lying. What are you hiding? He would say to me, look at me when I talk to you. And I couldn't. I looked and looked down. And when I start to go through this work, and I start little by slowly to kind of get some self-worth back and on different footing, and I would talk to my dad, he says, you're looking me in the eyes more than you ever did. You notice that? You talk to me like a man. Now, that was big for him. I never noticed it, but I was able to look at a man that I feared right in the eyes. And now when we speak, we're eyeball to eyeball. There's a mutual respect between father and son. Because God gave me enough to not be afraid, but to respect. It's a big difference. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. I was in this apartment, and there was a Knick game on. And I sat down and I watched, because I'm a Knick fan, I watched from tip-off to the end of the fourth quarter. I watched the whole game. Had a little lunch. Phone didn't ring. I didn't have to be on the phone. I didn't have a computer, but if I had one, on the phone, computer, smoking a cigarette, doing 400 other things because I can't stand silence. I watched the game from beginning to end by myself. Made a little lunch by myself. And when the game was over, it hit me. I just watched four quarters of a basketball game uninterrupted, and I was okay in my company. This was a major miracle. I needed people around me, but I was uncomfortable having people around me. I want to be alone, but I don't like being alone. I had to do something. Go somewhere, do something. I was all alone. Great. To be alone at perfect peace and ease. When I first got down to Florida, I got down here, I was alone. Ended a relationship that was up in Jersey. And I got down here, I knew Artie, that's all. And my boss. But Artie was like a friend already. I didn't know anyone. And I was living in a hotel, and in one of my sober houses, I had all my luggage, everything I owned, the rest was in storage, and my pockets were pretty empty. I slept at night fine. And after a month or two, I realized once again, I'm okay in my own company. I don't need anyone. I don't need to do anything. I'm totally okay, and I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that point, God gave me a neat relationship. God put great people in my life because I was open. I was okay with me, which means I'm ready to be okay with you. When I'm not okay with me, I need you to fix me. No good. Our fears fall from us, we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. It might be the infancy of one, but it's happening. We're in the spiritual water. We're in. Now we just need to get soul food and nurture it. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. How come so many of our needs tell us it's normal to think about a drink because you're an alcoholic? We tell newcomers that, and that is really a death sentence. My book says the feeling that the drink problem will disappear. In step 10, it tells me it's gone. Fifth step promise. Back in 5, they tell me it's going to feel like it's gone, disappeared. What great promise to someone like me who is driven by the bottle. And everything that encompasses. We feel we're on a broad highway walking hand in hand. That always said to me, oneness with God, not separateness, not duality. Hand in hand means we're connected. Hand in hand, I'm connected to my Creator. I walk with my Father, my Heavenly Father. There's some questions they asked us to do when we're done with step 5. We look at page 59, review the first 5 proposals. Have I skipped anything? They says, our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have I skipped more without sand? And I was given this out of an inspiration one time. Step 1, to review before I move on to 6 and 7. Do I still believe I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable? Because we can finish step 5 and say, hey, I'm good. I'm great. I didn't do anything else. I can manage my life. Do I still believe I have no power, choice, control before the first drink and after the first drink, mind and body? Do I still believe I can't manage my own life? Do I still believe my mind will take me back to a drink? Do I still believe I have a mind that would take me back to that which is killing me? Those are the sprees, because I could be not drinking, being on an awful sex spree. Oh my God, if she finds out, if he finds out, or a money spree, goes on and on. Do I still believe my body's quite as abnormal as my mind and my body will experience the phenomenon of craving when I drink or because I did step 5, I'm cured? I can cut back on my meetings now. I don't need to call my sponsor. Am I still willing to accept spiritual help in step 2? And if I don't know, I'll experience the bitter end. Am I still willing to have God restore me to sanity? Put down the drink, I'm getting God, and the other areas of my life that are out of order. If I'm dishonest in one area, my whole life is dishonest. If I'm cutting areas here, I'm cutting areas everywhere. A life which demands rigorous honesty. Do I still believe God can relieve me of my alcoholism? Am I still willing to believe in a power greater than myself? Step 3, considerations. Am I still convinced that my life when on self-will can hardly be a success? Drunk or sober, I'm an alcoholic and cannot manage my own life regardless of how long I'm sober. There's a difference between proper use of the will and managing my life. Am I still willing to quit playing God in every area of my life? Am I clear that in turning my will and life over to God, that my life is none of my business? And step four considerations, have I been thorough in every area into step five? Or if I try to leave some stuff on the side because God won't know. And I sat with these questions. And I hit step six that says if we can answer those questions to our own satisfaction, we've had a shift in consciousness. It's me and God. And I look at defects of character, which turns out to be our first step for life, our first step for living. And we turn that over to God as well. And next week we'll talk about that and get into steps 8 and 9. That's all I got, please.